Good morning. My name is not Tom Clammer. This is Mike Murphy filling in for Tom this morning. We're going to hear from David Cobb, founder of Move to Amend, later in just a couple of minutes. I had the opportunity to record a workshop he did on Move to Amend in St. Louis a couple of weeks ago, and we'll get to hear that. Well, primarily his voice, but we'll hear some of the participants in the workshop chiming in. But before we get to that, I do want to mention, if you've been listening to KKFI throughout the morning, you know that today is the 70th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima, and there are a few things going around town about that. There's an exhibit opening today at Miller Nichols Library at UMKC, 800 East 51st Street, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, 70 years beyond the bombings. The exhibit, it will run through October 4th, but the opening is from 5:30 to 7 this evening, and they will have tea and Japanese cookies at that event. Also in Lawrence, Kansas tonight, or this afternoon at the same time, at 5:30 at 9th and Massachusetts, the annual Hiroshima Day protest on the 70th anniversary, sponsored by the Lawrence Coalition for Peace and Justice. Also, there will be a few events coming up on Saturday. There's an ongoing vigil and fast to ban nukes at the new weapons plant at 150 Highway and Botts Road in Kansas City, Missouri. There's a prayer vigil. There's a Catholic mass Saturday morning at 9, prayer vigil that night, but an ongoing vigil and fast at that campus. And also on Sunday, which is the 70th anniversary of the bombing of Nagasaki, Remembering Nagasaki, Propagating Hope, from 2 to 4, Kansas City native and Pulitzer Prize-winning author Richard Rhodes speaking on the making of the atomic bomb and the twilight of the bombs. He'll be speaking at Community of Christ Temple in Independence, Missouri. More information for any of these, you can call Jane at 913-206-4088. And on KKFI from 3 to 5 on Sunday, the 70th anniversary on Global Roots Radio, there'll be some special music and some the words from someone who survived the Nagasaki bombing as read by her grandson. That comes up Sunday from 3 to 5 p.m. Also, tomorrow, Saturday, one other thing I forgot, there's a movie at 11:30 at the Tivoli, and it's called Message from Hiroshima. So all that coming up, and we're going to get on with David Cobb. First, we're going to play a couple messages, and we'll hear from David Cobb.
Life in Solitary Confinement on Sprouts, Thursday at noon.
Khadija, I heard about this radio show. It's about race.
What? A show about race?
Yeah, on the radio. It's on the community radio station, KKFI.
You're supposed to talk about that around your kitchen table.
Yeah, and that's what I thought, but it's actually on the radio talking about race and racial things.
What time is it?
It's 7 o'clock Thursday.
And what's the name of this show?
Khadija and the White Guy.
Say what?
Yeah, Keith Washburn and...
Khadija Hardaway.
See you then, Thursday night at 7 o'clock.
Women, War, and WikiLeaks, Saturday afternoon at 2:30.
Hi, I'm David Cobb, the Green Party's candidate for president in 2004. You know, the fellow who demanded a recount so that George Bush couldn't steal another election without at least there being some protests. Listen, you're listening to 90.1 KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station, your only source for non-corporately filtered news, information, and analysis.
Move to Amend, actually, the proposed amendment actually has two pieces. One, to abolish the idea that corporations are persons with constitutional rights. And the second
is to abolish the idea that money equals speech. The first thing I want to be clear about this is both of these are not just one court decision. They are doctrines. And in law, when we talk about doctrines, we're talking about an entire analytical framework that then actually becomes embedded, right? The idea that property rights are more sacred than human rights is a doctrine under the legal system, not only in the United States, but really in all of the West. We have to look to the Global South for human rights as an actual foundational part of the human existence, and indigenous peoples who still actually practice this kind of notion. And I say that to really be clear, it's not one court decision. It is not one law. We are talking about a doctrine that is manifesting the basic idea that property rights are more sacred than human rights, and that is a problem. And I'm also going to start and then end with the fact that we are really talking about the fact that our entire legal system, our political system, our economic system is actually profoundly flawed. In the United States of America, we have been taught to revere the Constitution as if it's the most important document given from on high. I am here to tell you we need to take a much more critical eye to this document, what it does, what it does not do. Because you know what it does not do? It does not actually, as a document, create a human right to the things that we need to survive. There is no right to clean air or clean water. There is no right to healthy, nutritious food to eat. There is no right to education or culture. There are none of the human rights that we actually need to survive actually embedded and protected and codified in the Constitution. And you know what else is not in there? Anything about the rights of Mother Earth herself. Nothing about the interconnected reality that we have, right? So I want to be very clear. I am a lawyer who, and I also, like, I do not revere and engage in what I call founder fetishism. You know, like, oh, the founder said, so you have to genuflect and you're supposed to, like, neither, though, am I going to, as we say where I'm from, throw the baby out with the bathwater. Mm-hmm. The idea of a written constitution that codifies rights that can be protected under law and that there will be a remedy, and ASA well knows, if there is not a remedy under law, then it's meaningless. It's meaningless if there's not a remedy for any transgression. So I know I went deep and hard on this, but I'm glad to see a lot of heads nodding and so forth. Citizens United is not the problem. Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission is a symptom. It is the most recent court case. And actually, I can't even say most recent, because now we've got to add Hobby Lobby, where the court said that corporations have the constitutional right to practice religion. What the hell? A corporation can practice religion? This is crazy, and we gotta say it. We gotta be willing to say it out loud. These folks are off, they're just off the tracks. This does not make sense. McCutcheon versus FEC, you can give unlimited amounts of money now. So these decisions are ongoing, and those are the questions around money as speech. The reason I wanna put both of them up, and this is really important, these are intricately related, but they are still different. It's not an alloy. You can't mush these together and really understand them. It is like a wire that's been tightly, tightly threaded to the point of being like a cable, right? Mm-hmm. But they're still different. The idea that money is speech is quite simple. The First Amendment of the United States Constitution says that we have the right to free speech. The government cannot tell me or any of you what we can say, how we can practice religion, if we practice religion. There are certain things that we have because of our inherent inalienable rights as human beings to speak, to have consciousness, to gather together, to assemble, to choose to engage in religious faith practices or not, as we see fit. And that's an important thing, because what it says is that the idea of democracy is not absolute. Which is to say, the majority cannot infringe upon the rights of the minority.
That's an important concept, and it's one that I hold dear, and I suspect everybody in this room holds dear. I hope you do. Like, we're not going to say that minorities, whether they're ethnic or racial minorities or political minorities or, you know, vegetarians or, like, whoever it is, right? Like no minority can be forced into compliance. There is an idea of the liberty of the individual being respected here. But here's the thing, right? A corporation, if money is speech, when we're talking about this one, if money is speech absolutely, then are they saying to us that we can't have reasonable laws to protect the integrity of the electoral process? Are they saying we can't have reasonable campaign finance laws? Are we saying that we, the people, don't get to govern how to have elections and how to make sure that they're proper? Well, here's the thing. The Supreme Court has said, basically, no. They have overturned a whole series of campaign finance laws where the ability to actually pass a campaign finance law in the last, say, 40 years has shrunk and shrunk and shrunk and shrunk to the point that when I remind people that it was once against the law in many states to use corporate money to even influence an election. Mm. Think about that. And in fact, it was a felony. It wasn't just a campaign finance law that you would get fined for. In the state of Wisconsin, it was a felony prosecuted. The president, officers of a corporation, the board of directors might be sent to jail. Not if they just gave money in an election, but if they spent corporate money in a way that a reasonable person would think they're trying to influence an election, because the idea was commerce is fine, but the political process is where we, the people, govern ourselves, and it's not a place where commerce should actually interfere with. So what we at Move to Mend says very clearly, campaign finance laws are political decisions. Now, I personally am a believer in full publicly funded elections at the local, state, and federal level. I want to get all money out of elections and recognize that elections are the infrastructure of democracy. And just as we should reasonably pay for the infrastructure of water and sewer and roads and trash pickup and schools and, you know, et cetera, so too should we pay for our own elections. Now, but I want to be clear, there are other people who say, no, I actually prefer just disclosure. Just let all the money come in, but make sure that we know that you have to say where your money came from, and you let others know. Others say, no, I want there to be a $100 limit on any of this. Somebody else might say, no, I want there to be unlimited amount of money, but you can only give money if you can vote in that election. Now, I want to point out, every single one of those things, I believe you could make a reasonable argument for that position, right? Again, I was very honest with you. I personally support completely publicly funded elections in all races. But those are political questions. It's not appropriate for the courts to step in and overturn a political decision. We, the people, are supposed to make those political decisions ourselves. This is a really important concept, right? So when we say to abolish the doctrine that money is speech, and I'm not handing out my brochure yet, because what I've learned from teachers is that if you give people something to look at while you're trying to talk to them, they'll stop listening to you and they'll read your thing. And it's proven to be true. You'll get one of these in a moment. But the point is, when you look at our specific language, all we're saying is we're abolishing the legal doctrine that money is First Amendment protected speech, so that local, state, and federal elected officials have the authority and the responsibility to pass campaign finance laws. That's it. So for us, we keep it, and because we're amending the Constitution, we're keeping it at the principle, like the principle of self-government, and not getting into the legislation of it. And I want to stop for a moment and see if, is this making sense so far? Is
Does anybody have any questions about this idea of money in elections and how we're going about it?
I have a ton of questions.
So,
I feel like you are on a new train, so I don't want to stop you.
Fair enough. Please, sir.
Well, given the two dichotomies that you have there, is the one amendment, the move to amend to, how does it incorporate that in one?
Hey, sir, I feel like one of those magicians who are supposed to say, sir, have we ever met before? Because that's such a perfect setup question.
Okay.
Asa is absolutely correct, because I was focusing on this one, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I put two concepts.
Mm-hmm.
And he's asking, well, do you have two amendments? The answer is no. Mm-hmm. We have one amendment with two sections. Mm-hmm. To make it clear that in one amendment we think both of these things need to be done. And Asa has invited me, which I will accept his invitation, to now get into the idea of abolishing the idea that corporations are persons with constitutional rights. And to do this, I am going to, in 10 minutes, give us a primer on how the U.S. Constitution is supposed to operate. I want to be clear, I was not taught this in law school. Right? They don't actually teach you this, but I'll invite you at the end of this little 10-minute segment to say, did I get this more or less right? The first thing I always like to ask is, what is the supreme law of the United States of America? What is the document that's supposed to be the document that provides us our principles of how we govern ourselves?
The Declaration.
Well, the Declaration of Independence was the first one that actually declared independence from
the Constitution.
Yeah, the U.S. Constitution is the actual document that says how we constitute ourselves. And the U.S. Constitution, when you read that document in its entirety, right, read the whole thing, I submit you'll see two big concepts. The first concept is probably the most important. In fact, it's so important, it's the first three words.
We the people.
Those are hallowed words in this country, and they should be, because we the people come together to create the second concept, which is government itself. Saying this another way, we the people create government. Government is dependent upon we the people. I like how some of my friends like to say it. They say, the people should never be afraid of the government. Actually, they say government should be
afraid of
the people. How many of y'all believe government is afraid of the people? I do. Because here's a follow-up question. It's a trick question a little bit, I admit it, but here's a question. If government is not afraid of us, why are they spying on us? If government is not afraid of us, why did President Obama, working with the Department of Homeland Security, issue orders to go in, disrupt, dismantle, and ultimately squash the Occupy movement, which was nothing more than ordinary people coming together and having conversations with each other? Because I had the privilege of going to Occupy encampments during the height of the Occupy encampment era. I probably went to 50 or 70 of them. Maybe more. And you know what I saw everywhere I went? People talking to each other. And that scared government and it scared the ruling elite. Because it wasn't just that people were talking to each other. They want us to talk to each other about sports and celebrity and fashion and buying stuff. But see, Occupy was having what the great poetess Audre Lorde calls unsanctioned conversation. Because at Occupy, they were asking the question, why does 1% rule 99% in a country that claims to be a democracy? They were asking, why do 25% of the children go to bed hungry in the richest country the world has ever seen? They were asking, what is this thing called the Federal Reserve that is actually a private banking consortium that controls the money supply of the United States of America? They were actually asking questions that scared the ruling elite and government itself. Because at the end of the day, we the people do have power, and we have far more power than we're actually exercising. And government actually knows that. In this constitutional framework, we the people are described and understood to be free and sovereign. And this idea of sovereignty is really important because, as Asa pointed out, the Declaration of Independence came before it. Because the Declaration of Independence said, the king is no longer sovereign. Because the word sovereign means the authority to rule. And there is something very powerful about the American narrative to say, we kick the king out, and not only that, we kick ass
over the largest empire the world had ever seen to that point. That's a big deal, and we ought to actually honor that. We ought to acknowledge that that is something important. And in the constitutional framework, we the people are sovereign. Government isn't sovereign over us. Government doesn't have the authority to rule over us. In fact, government is supposed to be subordinate and accountable. Government is supposed to be subordinate to whom?
The people.
Government is supposed to be accountable to whom? The people. That's got a ring to it, doesn't it? I like how this is going. We the people are free and sovereign because we the people have rights. Government does not have rights. Government only has duties. And as a lawyer, I'm going to stop for a moment and really underscore this. See,
and the Ninth Amendment defaults to the people.
It's supposed to, if it was actually being implemented.
Right.
But here's the thing. So, for example, Mike, if you have the right to do something, it means you can do it. You don't need my permission. You don't need this group's permission. You don't need the City Council of St. Louis. You don't need the Missouri State Legislature or the Kansas State Legislature. Thank goodness with the crazy-ass legislatures y'all got. But all I'm saying is, if you have the right to do something, you can do it. And government does not have to give you permission. In fact, it's even deeper than that. If government passes some law, the local, state, or even federal level, that interferes with your ability to exercise your inherent and inalienable constitutional rights, government's wrong, not you. You ought to be able to go into court and have that law overturned because it's an illegitimate exercise of political power to infringe upon your rights. And each and every one of us have that right. This is the concept, again, of individuality, of individual liberty, of freedom. Government cannot infringe upon our rights. Government never has rights over the people. Government has duties to the people. And a duty is different than a right. If you have a duty, it means you have a responsibility. You're supposed to have to do it. And this is back to the remedy. See, if there is a duty that is owed and is not done, then we ought to be able to force somebody to either pay compensatory money damages or act in a certain way to discharge those duties. And where do governmental duties come from? Well, remember, all power resides with the people. Power to the people was not merely a Black Panther Party chant. I mean, it was that. But that's actually, at its core, the idea of every liberatory movement that the world has ever seen, from the American Revolution to the women's suffrage movement, the abolitionist movement, the trade union movement, the civil rights movement, Greece and Spain, now all of the anti-colonial efforts of Africa in the 60s and 70s, all were premised upon the idea that ordinary people have the power to actually exercise autonomy, self-government, self-determination. And interestingly enough, just a very quick little thing, one of the things that I've been experimenting with is actually talking about self-government, comma, autonomy, comma, self-determination. Why? Because what I found is that in this country, white folks respond very well to self-government. Black folks, especially politically conscious ones, respond very well to self-determination. Anarchists respond very well to autonomy. Those words all mean basically the same thing. We got the right to decide how to construct our society and our civilization ourselves, right? So I'm being very transparent here. I'm now experimenting with trying to talk about these in all three ways so that whoever is hearing this will hear it and say, yeah, I'm down with that, right? Because I think all of us need to actually get into a liberatory framework. But hey, look, the people do have all the power. But that begs this question, right? Mike, what town do you live in again?
Kansas City.
Kansas City. How many people live in Kansas City, more or less?
400,000.
400,000? Yeah, I thought it would be about that. So 400,000 people. So I will say, in Kansas City, Kansas, those 400,000 people have all the political power. They are supposed to govern themselves. But I tell you this, I would hate to go to a meeting of 400,000 people in Kansas City where we decide, where should stop signs go? Right? Because it's not just that. Then you got to say, how many libraries will we have? Well, how many hospitals will we have? Well, how is trash going to get picked up? In other words, all of the municipal responsibilities, 400,000 people can't make that. Now, how many people live in the state of Kansas? About 4 million, I think.
Yeah, good guess. Now, Kansas, I'm on the Missouri side.
Missouri.
Yeah.
But you get my point, right? And there are 300 million Americans, actually 315 million. Can you imagine? Like, let's actually all get together and start to make policy decisions. That would be crazy. In our frame of government, we the people hold all the political power, but we delegate a certain amount of our power to government. Do we delegate all our power to government? Hell no! We only delegate enough power for government to perform the duties that we the people have told them to do. And how does government perform those duties? They write public policy or public laws. But remember, the one thing that no public policy can ever legitimately do is to violate the private rights of the people who live there. And I told you in 10 minutes I'd give a big overview of the U.S. Constitution. It's at 8 minutes. So now I will in 1 minute tell you in one sentence how the U.S. constitutional framework is supposed to operate. Now, this is a run-on sentence to be sure, but it's still just one sentence. Watch this. In the United States Constitution, we the people are free and sovereign because we hold all the political power. But we wisely delegate a certain amount of our power to government, which we will always hold to be subordinate and accountable. We will charge government with the duty to write public laws at the local, state, and federal level. But the one thing that no public law can ever do is to violate the private rights of the free and sovereign people who live there. Nice. Ta-da! Right? Isn't that cool? I mean, I say that, and when I say that, I get proud. It's like, this is brilliant. This is beautiful. We should try that in this country. Because this would totally work. And I'm not joking. This is brilliant. I'm not joking that this is beautiful. And I'm also not joking that we've never actually tried it. Because before I go one second further waxing poetic about the Constitution, a quick timeout. Somebody tell me what year the Constitution gets ratified. What is the year the Constitution ratified in this country?
1792?
89. That was the Bill of Rights that you just went to. 1789 is the ratification date. The reason I want 1789 on the board is so that we can have a moment in time. That's when the Constitutional Convention is 1787, right? Yeah. By the way, before that it was called the Articles of Confederation. In between the Declaration of Independence and the war and the first government, the Articles of Confederation, look at that. Premised upon the Iroquois Confederation and the great law of the indigenous people, a lot to learn there. Don't have time to go into it now, but if you're for extra credit, if you're really interested, look at the Articles of Confederation. But I want to go to 1789, which is when the document is first created that we've been taught to revere. So in 1789, who was we the people? What were the characteristics of the human beings that could claim the inherent inalienable rights of being a human being? What were their characteristics?
Property owner.
You had to be a property owner.
And white.
And white.
Had to be male.
Had to be a man. So here's the thing. We have to really be crystal clear. Yes?
Well, finish what you were saying.
We have to be crystal clear about what it was to be a legal person to be able to claim constitutional rights. You had to be a white, male, property owner. You know what percentage of the actual human beings who lived in the what is now called the United States at the time, those 13 colonies that are now states, you know what percentage of those human beings could claim the inherent rights of a human being? Any guess? 15%. 15%? It's a good guess, but you're not sufficiently cynical. 5%. Which means 95% of the human beings were not legal persons. The indigenous human beings who are already here were not only not persons with any rights, they were subject to intentional, deliberate effort to genocide. The enslaved Africans were clearly not persons with rights. They were brought at the barrel of a gun or the end of a whip or a spear or a sword and forced to build this country with slave labor. And we, and frankly, white people have got to talk about that clearly, unambiguously, not to get some sort of pat on the head, but so that we can have clarity about what the hell racism and white supremacy really means and the impacts of it so that we can deconstruct it, right? All I'm getting, oh, and by the way, women were not persons. Women were chattel property. They were literally under law subject to the relationship of the men in their lives.
The question is more an observation question, maybe it's not, because I didn't tell him, but take the French Constitution, the Declaration of Man, that came out in the same year. My understanding was there was a lot of tension between the French and the American for the type of revolution that was.
There is no doubt.
And Adams was a libertarian, promoted those land rights over equality and
So tell us the three principles of the French Revolution. Listen to these.
Fraternity, equality, and
liberty.
And liberty.
Liberty.
So brotherhood or the communal experience, let's call it that way, right? Equality and liberty versus property rights for a people who already owned property.
That was a distortion.
It was a profound, yes.
So now we are 2015, and maybe it's a bit of a leap in the conversation, but the danger to have a written constitution that was drafted in a time for specific people and refer to that document as the Bibles, where we all assume we have the same right, is should a constitution be organic then? Every 50 years be redrafted, revised?
Yes, I think so, is the short answer.
Okay.
And we'll get into that. That is a level of specificity, but the short answer, yes. I actually believe every generation should write a new constitution.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right? And why? Because it's the supreme law of the land. We should actually have the authority to say, we're here. How do we want to govern ourselves?
Yeah.
We can learn from what our parents and grandparents and forebears did, and you know, both right and wrong. But we might want to do things completely differently. All I'm getting at is, from its inception, this document was flawed. Not because of the words or the concepts, but because of the idea of who was a person with constitutional rights. And it took mass movements, broad, deep, conscious movements to ensure that we ended slavery in this country, that black and brown folks had any rights at all, that women had rights, that the civil rights, these are movements, right? And it takes mass movements to make change. Having a good idea and being correct on your analysis is important, but not enough. We've got to, and this is really where I'm bearing down on the Green Party, we as Greens have got to get much better at having ordinary conversations with ordinary people to bring them into a consciousness around our principles and values of peace, justice, democracy, and sustainability. And actually talk about the beautiful, wonderful life that they and their children are going to live under this new frame of government and society. And frankly, I'm going to also push a little deeper and say, I think the Green Party's got to get much more clear about being a peaceful, loving, revolutionary party.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually about a revolution in how we conduct ourselves, both socially, politically, and economically, on the world stage. So, this concept of personhood and having rights is very important. And now, let me remind you that corporations are persons with rights. How the hell did that happen? Short answer, the court created it out of whole cloth. They totally made it up, right? Because here's what it once took to form a corporation in 1789 for the next basically 100 years. First, your application did not go to some trivial clerk. It actually went to the State House of Representatives where they voted on it and they debated it. And you had to get a majority vote in the State House of Representatives just to get articles of incorporation. And that's not enough, because if you got a majority vote in the State House, it then goes to the State Senate, where they debate it, discuss it, vote on it. You got to get another majority vote. And that's still not enough, because after a majority vote in the State House, a majority vote in the State Senate, it now goes to the governor, who looks at the paperwork and has to be willing to sign off on it. And if the governor won't sign off on it, you don't have articles of incorporation. Does that sound anything like creating a corporate charter today? Of course not. What did I just describe? Majority vote of the State House. Majority vote of the State Senate. Governor signs it.
Law.
Peter, I just described the law. This is very important. For 100 years in this country, getting the privilege, not the right, the privilege of limited liability incorporation required a political act that was the functional equivalent of legislation. Because the founders, for all their faults, and they are legion, one thing that they knew and understood was the privilege of limited liability incorporation was something that should be created in very limited terms. Let me finish this and I'll come to you, Asa. For example, not only was the application process very difficult, but when you applied, you had to prove that there was some public need that was not being met, right? And if you were granted the privilege of limited liability incorporation, the only type of business you could do was the narrow type of business to create that and fill that public need. Oh, and by the way, that charter was only good for 5, 10, 15 years, limited in space, right? So, and here's the kicker. Not only was it a difficult process to do politically, not only was it limited in time, not only was it limited in what you could do, but if you ever did anything to violate the public interest or the public trust with your corporation, guess what happened to your corporate charter? Revoked. Corporate charters were routinely revoked for merely acting outside the public interest, which leads me to this question. Can anybody think of a single one of the Fortune 500 corporations or the mega transnational corporations that could even operate under these political restrictions that the founders once had?
No.
Asa, you had a point. Thanks for holding it.
You know, given the context in which you describe the origins and the historical legacy of what how companies was formed, I mean, I'm not intimate into the legal arguments and went into Cincinnati. Did any lawyer argue that given this historical context of corporation, the court has no authority here because this is a political question?
The answer is yes, and I say with some humility, you're looking at it. The same reason that your lawsuit on the 14th Amendment did not prevail. Yeah. Because here's the thing, Asa makes the mistake that many people make, which is to look at the law, to apply logic and reasoning, and say, well, clearly the result must be this.
Right.
I appreciate it. I also frequently fall into that.
Yeah.
Here's the point, y'all. This is not a legal question. Mm-hmm. It's not even a political problem. We have a cultural problem in this country because we have been trained to be obsequious and subservient to a system that is fundamentally racist, fundamentally sexist, fundamentally class oppressive, and let's just be honest, is going to destroy the planet that we depend upon for life itself if we don't interrupt it. I'm going to tell you something. Civil disobedience is not the problem in this country. Civil obedience is the problem in this country. We are being obedient to oppressors. We are being obedient to people who seem to be, and I say this very delicately, sincerely, seem to be mentally ill. And I have mental illness in my family, so I don't use that lightly at all. People who are mentally ill need and deserve help, right? The problem in this country is that the mentally ill people are in charge because they have gotten so wrapped up in greed and accumulation and power that they seem to be willing to take us over a cliff and destroy everything in this short-sighted desire to accumulate more stuff. That's the functional definition of an addict. They are addicted to power and wealth accumulation. And honestly, if we had a just and compassionate healthcare system, single-payer healthcare, if we had a just and compassionate healthcare system, we would get these people help. And instead, we really did put them in charge, and that's kind of collectively our fault. It's a ship of fools. So here's the thing. We now know that it takes an action of government to create the corporation. We know that the corporate charter can be used to hold the corporation subordinate and accountable. We understand that the corporate charter describes the duties of what a corporation can or cannot do. We understand that a corporation should only be allowed to exist if it serves the public interest. So isn't it obvious that a corporation should go here in our framework? And here comes the punchline. When the court comes waltzing in and says, notwithstanding history, notwithstanding precedent, notwithstanding common sense, five of us are going to tell 300 million of you that under law and in culture, You have to treat a corporation as if it's a person with rights. It perverts the whole thing. See, corporate personhood is the illegitimate court-created idea that a corporation is a person with constitutional rights. And what that means is now corporate lawyers can go into court and overturn any environmental protection law, any worker safety law, any public health law, any campaign finance law. There's not a single law that is not subject to being challenged in the courts. And we are no longer actually fighting over the legitimacy of that. Move to Mend represents a new phenomenon. Really appreciated Asa and several of you who talked about how Move to Mend seems to be coming up. Here's the thing, y'all. First, I'm going to do this. I'm going to now pass out our proposed amendment. And so just take one of these, and if you look on the back, you will see the actual amendment that has been proposed into Congress. You'll see it's got two sections. The first one deals with abolishing corporate constitutional rights. The second with money and speech. It's on the very back of the brochure. It has already been introduced in Congress. The second thing I'm going to share with you is that Move to Amend, because I've now erased what it does because you've actually got the language, and that has been vetted by multiple lawyers. Congress people are actually now, we're up to six or seven. But the other thing I want to say is Move to Amend was founded in 2010. We were 12 people in the living room. Today, sometime next month, Move to Amend is not going to be 12 people. We're going to be 400,000 people. And we're growing every day. We're 390-some thousand right now. And we've helped 600 communities pass resolutions of support. That is, campaigns actually where city council members or county boards of supervisors or the district votes to say, we support a constitutional amendment. And get this, we've been on the ballot 300 times. What's the difference there? Well, 600 times have city council members voted on it. 300 times we've been able to put it to the voters, let ordinary people vote on the idea. We've been on the ballot 300 times. Guess how many times we've won? 300. We haven't lost yet. And yes, that includes San Francisco and Boston and Madison, the liberal bastions. You know where else we've won? Salt Lake City, Utah. We won in Devlin, Wisconsin. Why Devlin? Why do I mention that? That's the hometown of Republican Tea Party Governor Scott Walker, where they haven't voted for a Democrat for president or Congress in 40 years. Move to Amend was on the ballot in Devlin, Wisconsin. We won by 74% of the vote. Move to Amend language was on the ballot in the state of Montana. Yeah, that Montana. Statewide initiative, we won by 76% of the vote. All I'm saying is that Move to Amend's language has been vetted and is winning and uniting liberals, conservatives, moderates, and radicals. Democrats, Republicans, Greens, Libertarians, cowboys, hippies, and anarchists, black nationalists, you name it, ordinary people, when they look at what we're proposing, because it's a principle, it's not a policy decision, it's just a principle of self-determination, autonomy, self-government. We're winning everywhere we go. And I'm going to now invite each of you, if you're not already getting Move to Amend emails, it's about every 2 weeks or so, I'm going to pass this around. Now, let's start one on this side. And if you don't want to join Move to Amend, you don't have to. Don't be offended. I mean, I won't be offended, right? I'll be surprised, but I won't be offended. But I see that Jill is quickly working on that. Julie. So I'll just say, Julie, you and Mike, everybody, print legibly. As an organizer, there's nothing, you know what I'm talking about, there's nothing more frustrating. Somebody signs up, they want to join, they want to get involved. If Ruby and I can't read it, you haven't joined anything. So if, like me, you have bad handwriting, slow down. Take your time, right? Really, because we want to get you connected. I got you, and I'm going to, so we'll go here and here. Yes, Michael. No.
Frederick.
Frederick.
we look at the history of since 1789, the Palace Supreme Court is reacting to corporation or the charters. What's the evolution? I mean, it seems like there's a trajectory. Where are we going with all that?
Where we're going to fascism. I'm glad you asked the question. So where are we going with this? Fascism. Explicit. I think we've got to get more comfortable saying the F word in this country. Because remember that Benito Mussolini, the fascist dictator of Italy, who was also a political theorist, said fascism more properly should be called corporatism because it merges the economic might of the corporation with the military might of our nation. And he thought that was a good thing. Franklin Roosevelt at the same time period said you cannot allow the power of corporations to become more powerful than the democratic state. That is the essence of fascism. So where are we going, Frederick? Where we're heading is to what I sometimes call a kinder, gentler fascism.
Yeah,
so it's not as explicit and ugly, but take a look around. You know, look, we are just outside of Ferguson. And I know, and I hope all Greens know, that there has been a profoundly tragic and disgusting history of black and brown people being murdered in this country. So Michael Brown was not an anomaly, right? But I remember watching on the television tanks, SWAT teams going out in the streets. They weren't dealing with protest originally. They were dealing with ordinary people coming together expressing anguish over the murder of a child. He was an 18-year-old kid, right? And we saw a police, militarized police response to that. That's something new. I don't know what else we should call that. But you had a comment or a question? Or
actually, I was just touching my ear.
You touch your ear?
There was once a time, of course, there was a college that had the same issue. Was it back in the 70s? When they did the same thing and they shot a lot of college students for protesting. And, you know, since that's happened, there was a lot of change after that. How did we overcome that and incorporate, you know, some of the things? Because if you don't know your history, you're bound to repeat it. How are we, like, showing the people that this is happening reoccurringly, and it's because of the fact that we're apathetic and not really understanding that if we don't encourage this unionized educational support of, like, Mother Jones and, you know, union leadership, you know, human rights activists that are getting together and doing these things, it should be all in. It should be together. We shouldn't be separating these pieces. We should be bringing it together. This is all one fight. It's just happening in different time zones.
No, that's you said a lot there, and it was all interconnected because it is all interconnected. So my quick reaction is, first, I appreciate you bringing up Kent State, and I am actually going to push one bit further and point out it is only because we live in such a profoundly white supremacist, racist state that people know Kent State, but they don't know Jackson State University
right.
In Mississippi, where within the same month, 7 black students got murdered by the National Guard. But no, very few people know that story. So thank you for reminding us about Kent State, and I'm going to also bring the spirit of Jackson State into the conversation and the implications. And one of the reasons that Move to Mend is growing is because we insist that we talk about issues of race and gender and class within this movement in Move to Mend. Now, we don't insist that that be talked about on the ballot referendum, because you don't go into Montana and try to win a ballot a referendum on that kind of rhetoric and language. But what we do say is we need to build an organization that actually has an understanding of these things as we build out. Second thing that I really want to underscore about what you said, and sister, what was your first name?
Kshatriya.
That Kshatriya pointed out that I think is so important is the interrelationship between people's activism and media and like this notion, and the one pushback I would say is she used the word apathetic. See, I don't think that people are apathetic, because apathy means that you don't care. I think people are cynical, which means that they don't think they can do anything about it. And that subtle difference is really important. Because if somebody is really and truly apathetic and they don't care, we can't reach them. They're lost to us. But if they're merely cynical, what it means is we've got to convince them that our plan can win. And Move to Men's plan can win because it's deep enough, it's systemic enough, and frankly, the Green Party can win because it is actually a way to take these concepts and put it on the ballot. And not just for Move to Men as an issue, but to get people elected to office that will change all of the laws, that will address the climate crisis, that will address the police brutality, that will actually change policy to allow for a living wage, that like all of the things that we heard on the stage last night can be possible when Greens are elected, because Greens are getting elected and are proving that we can govern. So here's the thing, again, at the end of the day, my appeal to the Green Party is that Greens should get more active and Move to Amend as an issue campaign. Because one of the four pillars of the International Green Party movement is grassroots democracy. You cannot have democracy if corporations are persons with constitutional rights of money and speech. Greens ought to be leading. And the other thing I want to do is, because kids love the stickers, you've already got one decal, a postcard that you can choose to use. I'm now going to pass out some stickers that I'm going to encourage y'all to use. And lastly, a couple more, like, we love to give out the swag, and so I'm giving out Move to Men swag for everybody to have, and I'm going to say this. Is there anybody, this is an honest question, because we're coming to the end, is there anybody that's been so engaged by this conversation that, and if the answer is no, it's totally fine. But is there anybody here who thinks, I might be willing to have a conversation about what it would take to start a local Move to Amend effort in my community? And yeah, yeah. So really, could you make sure, could you just check, it's Julie and Frederick. And make sure that we can read their email and telephone number because we'll follow up with you. You are in New Jersey?
Yeah.
Manhattan.
So, yeah, there's some people there, but the reality is we don't have a functioning group because it takes a lot of effort, right? So I'm going to stop because I want to be respectful of everybody's time. I know that I basically gave a presentation. It wasn't nearly the kind of dialogue that we would do if there was more time, but we had a lot to cover. So I did want to just stop and ask, especially those people who we haven't heard from, are there any comments, questions that that you would like to share? Did this work?
Just one question. The reason why I have the declaration is that, you know, I've been giving presentations on the role of U.S. colored troops in fighting for the passage of the 14th and 15th Amendment. And Fannie Stevens, one of his argument was the declaration of the white abolitionists, the declaration is our organic constitution.
Yes.
And so they dismissed the Constitution 1787 to the extent that it deviated from the declaration. So whenever you see about the Reconstruction, you see the declaration all in caps. That's the way they did it. They were saying that anything that is inconsistent with the declaration means all people are created equal, you know, is invalid. So that's why after the Civil War, they say that we have to amend our Constitution to be consistent with our organic Constitution, which is the Declaration.
That's correct. In fact, William Lloyd Garrison, one of the great leading abolitionists, used to go to public meetings, stand up in the podium, rip up the Constitution, and he called it a contract with the devil himself. Why? Because he enslaved human beings. And he said, what else could that be?
With the devil in agreement with hell.
Yes. Well done. That's exactly right. That's the quote. And you're right. In fact, if you look at Wisconsin, here's something really interesting. This may go, I'll say anyway, it may only make sense to Asa. In Wisconsin, the first states' rights argument
was Wisconsin arguing that they had the right to refuse to follow the law of the Fugitive Slave Act and other things, because they were arguing that the national laws and the Supreme Court that upheld it were actually violating the and they called it the Liberty Constitution, which was the Declaration of Independence, and they just said it was illegitimate, and we had the right to refuse to do it. So it's a very interesting thing. It's about who controls the frame of the fundamental principle of how government operates. So at the end of the day, Move to Mend is a campaign that is getting larger, stronger, and better organized every year. We are working with people across the political platform, across ideology, everywhere in the union, and I hope that you will take a look at, perhaps your local Green Party might endorse Move to Mend. Perhaps your local Green Party might get more involved. Maybe the state party could actually have a platform plank on supporting the Move to Mend language. Anything that you might be interested in doing through the Green Party, we are interested. Now, we work with Democrats, Republicans, Libertarians, and Independents alike, right? So we are very clear. But I'm here at a Green Party convention. So I'm appealing to you as Greens to engage with us. And the last thing I'm going to do is give you a telephone number to the national office. And if you want some help with a platform proposal, if you want some help on anything like that, the telephone number is 707. It's not on that. 707-269. There's a pen that I think we have Frederick's pen. 707-269-0984.
One more time.
707-269-0984. Any other last comments? So I'll stick around.
One little commercial. in the Green Papers in 2010, I wrote an article called Questions for Neo-Confederate Justice. And it says, Questions for Neo-Confederate Justice, an expose of legal Darwinism and neo-Egyptian federalism. And then there it talks about some of the philosophical concept that went into defining person, called the personhood. So just go back to your Green Papers back issues and Questions for Neo-Confederate Justice.
All right. Well, thank you. A good organizer always takes the opportunity to lift that up. So I never offended when a good organizer organizes.
And we just heard David Cobb, the Green Party's 2004 presidential candidate and one of the founders of Move to Amend, giving a workshop on Move to Amend, the movement to amend the Constitution to undo the money equals speech and that corporations are people doctrines. And that was done. This was recorded at the Green Party's annual national meeting a couple weeks ago in St. Louis. And that does it for Tell Somebody. This will be online, as well as last week's program. Tom interviewed Richard Rhodes right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for Larry J. and My Place.
90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Streaming online at www.kkfi.org.